All right, here we go. Hey, I'm pretty excited. I'll tell you why. First of all, my name is Bromo. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 2/17/09. It is a chilly 0 degrees out here in Bismarck on a Saturday on the, what is it, the 18th of January. Going to be about -5 is the high on Monday. Looking forward to that. But what really gets me, gets my heart going and gets me in a mood like no other is when I talk sobriety. As all of you who have listened to my podcast before, they heard my story a billion times. My true strength are my guests. And this one today is a real honor for me, a real treat. And I'll tell you why real quick. He is from San Diego. I met him probably 8 or 9 years, and I'll verify that with him in a second. I go out to San Diego as much as I can, but I go out about twice a year. And when I do, I stay with my best friend out there, and he's in the program. And we're all... 3 or 4 of us at one point around the poker table playing cards, smoking cigars, but we're stone sober. And when sobriety does come up from time to time on the table, we all can relate and we all talk to each other about it. And a couple of weeks ago, I was kind of having a rough spout. I wasn't sure if I was into the dry drunk era or not. And I had told my best friend some things about it. And he had relayed this to my next guest who's coming up in seconds. As soon as I'm done blabbing, and he was kind enough and gracious enough to discuss it with my friend and said, you know what? You know what he's doing with his podcast? That's kind of a meeting for him. Patrick, how are you, buddy?
Hey, Bromo, what's going on? I'm doing good. How are you?
Hey, you know what? I'm thrilled to be talking to you, buddy. It's, when you meet Patrick within seconds, first of all, you realize he'll be after your money if you're playing poker. Within seconds, though, you'll see what a great guy he is. Instantly, you're his friend, shaking a big old hand, and you bring up sobriety, and we can talk about it for the longest time. What is your sobriety date?
Hey, Bremel. So my sobriety date is November 11th, 2004.
Awesome.
And, I've got a sponsor. His name is Rick C. I know you know him.
I sure do.
I got a home group. My home group is... the Mira Mesa Alano Club, a Wednesday noon meeting. It's called Resentment in a Coffee Pot.
Yep.
And, I am, just happily sober, my friend. And back at you, as soon as we sit down to play cards or do anything, the smiles and the hugs and the love just comes out. It's just, I can't quit smiling.
Listen, for those of you out there who are on the fence or hard, who are really trying, and aren't we all, for those of you who, when you first start out, you're thinking, man, how can I be happy in sobriety? This is a prime example. When I go out to San Diego, I'm surrounded with love. Cards and money flying out of my pocket, losing. Cigar, loving it. But also, now that I'm out here in Bismarck, and I've been out here in North Dakota for over 10 years now, approaching 11, I know if I'm having a rough time, I can reach out to people here, of course, but I can place a couple of phone calls to San Diego, and they're right there with me. And you know as well as I know, that's the greatest feeling in the world, isn't it?
Oh, it is. I mean, it's like a brotherhood, for us. And just, I might meet someone, in my day-to-day, travels, and someone might say they're in the program. And, it's just an immediate connection. You just know that you can count on that person for so many things that, you may not be able to count on regular people for. It's just an elite club, and I am so grateful to be a member.
I love that you said elite club because, we're not trying to be pompous or anything, but this is an elite club. This is a group of people, men and women, who are there for each other, who are going through the same thing that we are, the temptations and the daily thoughts of reminders. I had brought up to my last guest before, last week, about having dreams, and I had such a violent one 3 weeks ago with an alcoholic dream in it, so crystal clear. Remembering everything that I know now, telling myself in my dream, man, I'm going to get to 16 years, but I'm faking it the whole time. I've been drinking behind everyone's back. And Patrick and my friend, who's basically my co-sponsor, talked about this for quite a while at the poker table. And Patrick, I'm very curious what your thoughts are on that first before you get into your story, okay?
Yeah, no problem at all. And, I was really happy, that our mutual friend, he's my best friend too, I would say. He's just an amazing guy and,
yep.
Also kind of my co-sponsor. But, he brought it up, and first of all, we miss you. I'm glad you're up there, and I'm glad you're doing well, but boy, we miss you down here. And anytime you come up, it's always a fun topic. And, but, you know, when you brought it up about your dream and you, you know, kind of struggling with what it meant, or, you know, feeling really kind of waking up and feeling like you might be a little bit dry, you know,
yeah.
You know, first of all, anyone that's been sober for any amount of time has probably had one of these drinking dreams, you know, or if you're an addict, you know, perhaps it's one of the, you know, it's a drug dream or something. And, you know, the dreams are so vivid, like, you know, so many dreams are, and you wake up in the dream thinking, oh my God, like you just said, you know, I've put away 20 years of sobriety. And, you know, in my case, you know, I've got a wife and a family and, you know, coworkers and people in the program. And I just, my first thoughts are always like, oh my God, I have to tell my wife. I have to tell my friends. I've got to make an announcement in the meetings,
yeah.
You know, and, the feeling is, it is probably the worst feeling I could ever imagine. It truly is like you woke up and you've relapsed. And,
yeah.
You know, I don't know about you, but one of the things I learned on my, you know, my path to recovery is my most valuable possession in the world is my sobriety date. And, it's more of a prized possession than my marriage, than my family, than my career, than my 6-year-old son, you know, than my older kids. It's the very most valuable thing I own. And without that, you know, I've learned I'm a dead man, you know, so waking up from a dream thinking you've thrown all that away, it is, you know, it'll make you want to throw up.
Yeah.
And it's rough, you know,
but I'll tell you what, I've said this too for the longest time, and I'm going to run this by you. I always think it's your brain keeping you battle ready. It's your brain telling you you're one step away from, making a mistake that you'll yeah. never, ever forget, and going and taking one drink. The last time I relapsed before my sobriety date, and then the very last time, and I went on a 2-day drinking haul, I remember I had been sober for over a month, thought that I was doing okay, but I really hated going to meetings then. I really couldn't stand the sight of another energy drink and a croissant or anything.
And a cigarette.
Yeah, and it was right around Valentine's Day, and I'm hearing all these people outside when I lived in Mission Beach, which is like Disneyland for alcoholics or booze and all that stuff. But I remember when I walked through the alleyway so nobody would see me, and I walked about a mile to a liquor store because all the other liquor stores around there knew me, and I bought a couple of tall boys and a little tiny martini glass, and I cracked that open and took a sip, and I cried. Immediately, I knew it. I cried. I said, I'm done. Here we go.
Yeah.
Another hell coming. And sure enough, it did. It really almost did take my life, because I wound up going to the hospital a couple day and a half later, and they strapped me to the bed, and my blood pressure wanted to kill me. Right when I went in, they said, well, you're in the best place to have a stroke. And yeah. I don't want that anymore. And, you know, it takes a long, long time. We're going to listen to your story in a second. It takes a long, long time to get to the point. Like you said so perfectly, it's the most special, most honored, most, it's when 2/17 rolls around for me, that whole day when I wake up and go to bed at night is my favorite day of the freak in my lifetime. And it's way better than my normal birthday. And I go and, yes, I don't mind shouting it out and telling everybody, hey, today's my sixth, if I get there, my 16th birthday, you know. I agree yeah. with everything you said is so clear.
Yeah, you know, it's those dreams, they suck. And I haven't had one, you know, for a while. And part of my story is drugs. And I think probably my last one was a drug dream. And it's almost, you know, in some of those dreams, like when you're in a fighting dream, you can't quite throw the punch. Or when you're in a, yeah. you know, I've been in drinking dreams where you can't quite get it to your lips.
Yeah.
You know, although, you know, you still wake up with this, you know, impending doom feeling that you have drank. And, or done the drugs, but like our friend says, and he said it the other night when we were at the poker table, is he thinks of those dreams. I think he has them maybe once a year, once every couple of years.
Yeah.
But he's like, you know, it's like a week-long gift. And I, what do you mean? And he said, well, it's like, you know, it's like you get to kind of float by what a relapse would be like, and all the cheating and the, you know, lying, cheating, stealing, you know, we're a bunch of horse thieves, you know. And he's like, it's like a gift. It's like a gift that lasts like a week, because you get to kind of wear what it would have been like to have relapsed, you know,
yep.
And but you didn't. And so, you know, it is definitely a funky thing. And, you know, and you touched on, you know, maybe feeling like you were practicing. I call it, you know, some of my friends call it AA light. You know, so there's like, you know, real Coke, and then there's like, you know, then there's Coke Light.
Yeah.
And so, you know, sometimes in my life, you know, I've been sober for a while, and there's definitely been times where it'll either be pointed out to me by some of my, you know, really good friends in the program, whether it be my sponsor or, you know, guys like you, that might go, hey, you know, I haven't seen you in a meeting. You know, you missed last week.
Yeah.
And you're on vacation the week before that. You know, it's been a month. And I'll go, a month? What do you mean? And they go, well, it's been a month. Like, look at a calendar.
Yeah.
And they go, you know, you practice an AA light? Like, what do you got going on? You know,
yeah.
And they call me on it. And certainly I can see where you might think, you know, being up there a little isolated, maybe you, you know, maybe you're feeling like you're, you know, a little dry right now.
Right.
And, you know, I think those feelings are natural. I definitely, when I have those dreams, I play the tape. You know, I play what it would be like to drink. I make sure I thoroughly watch that movie.
Yeah.
And I remind myself what, you know, what it's like if I take that first drink. I have no doubt what it would be like. So, you know, again, it kind of gets back to being a gift for me. But, you know, it can take a while to shake that that feeling. And it's definitely awful. I'm glad I don't have them too much anymore.
Well, Patrick, if you can, pretend like we're in a meeting right now and your name has been called or however they do it. And if you go to meetings, there's different processes. A lot of meetings, you can volunteer yourself. A lot of meetings, have you ever been in the meetings, Patrick, where they have a bell and if you go on too long, they ding it? Ding!
Yeah. The old timers will yell at you. I love that.
You're not going to have that here. So pretend like, Patrick, you've just been called up and there's no topic now. The topic is what you want to share. Share about your life and your story if you want. It's all up
sure.
to you. Okay, because I would love, this is why I say from the beginning of my podcast, my guests are my strength. I hope everybody can listen to them. Anyway, it's all yours, pal. Take it away if you want. And if I interrupt every once in a while, I apologize.
Yeah, not a problem, Bruno. Well, you bring it. And, you know, and yeah, I, you know, it's taken me a while to be able to, you know, tell my whole story and, you know, let go of some of the shame. You know, I've done some pretty bad stuff in my past. But, you know, for me, I would just say, you know, taking it from the beginning, you know, the first time I, you know, I was probably 11 or 12 years old, probably 10 or 11, really, when I, you know, me and my best friends back on his street, you know, back when you used to run the neighborhood with your friends and you'd be out till the streetlights came on, you know, somehow this, you know, this crazy street of all these little hooligans that we all hung out with, we, everyone went to their parents' liquor cabinet and everyone got a, you know, a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And I'll never forget my first drunk was, you know, God, I was probably 10 or 11.
Now, is this in San Diego, Patrick?
Yeah. San Diego, Mira Mesa. Yeah.
Okay.
Got it. And, you know, it was, you know, it was like Lord of the Flies really. And, we were all drinking and, you know, half of us got sick, you know, and I just remember thinking, you know, man, that was great. And so I feel like I, you know, I leaned towards, you know, substances to take me out of, you know, my head or, you know, my life right away. And, you know, and it wasn't too long after that, I had an older brother and my best friend, he had an older brother and, you know, and the older brothers kind of led the way and they were smoking weed and then we were smoking weed and, you know, so at a young age, I was, you know, drinking, sneaking a little bit here, a little bit there, and, you know, smoking weed and that sort of thing. And, you know, and as I got a little bit older, you know, not by much, you know, 12, 13, I had a job working at a local plant nursery. And I'd go to school, and, you know, I was always a really good student. But I'd go to school, and after school, I would work in this plant nursery and water the plants. That was my job. And I was under the table, $2.50 an hour. And, and I remember the owner of the nursery, he had these speed pills. He had these little things that are called crosstops. And I know that we're on a, you know, an Alcoholics Anonymous podcast. I know, but I feel like, you know, talking about other substances for a minute might.
No, we're on it. You know what, Patrick, we're on an alcohol drug. We're on an addictive podcast, okay?
Great. Because, you know, like some, my best friend always told me, he said, man, you better be careful what you brush up against because you're going to be addicted to it. So
yeah.
That's the perfect podcast for me. But anyway, so, you know, next thing you know, I was doing these little crosstop pills, these little tiny speed pills. And next thing you know, I think I've always kind of been an entrepreneur type guy. And I thought, you know, if I were to, you know, just turn some of my friends at school, you know, I was at junior high, if I was to turn some of my friends onto these and they were to give me a buck or two, you know, that's not a big deal. Well, next thing you know, I'm in the principal's office in eighth grade. And,
oh,
I, you know, and there's the police officer and, you know, someone had taken one too many and they got the nurse and my name had come up. And the next thing you know, I'm getting expelled a couple weeks before the end of my eighth grade year.
Eighth grade.
Yeah, it was rough. It was rough for sure. Now, I will add in there that I logged in straight A's, even not finishing the last couple of weeks of school there. But you know, it was that was kind of the path I was on. And you know, my mom tried. You know, she was a great mom, and she tried to do everything on her own. She was a single parent. But me and my brother were a handful. You know, and so just jumping forward a little bit, a couple of years later, I'm in a car accident with my mom. She's driving, and we're at a party for a guy, and it's a birthday party. We're down at the harbor, San Diego Harbor.
Yep.
And she gets behind the wheel in a friend's new car, and me and my best friend Travis, we jump in the back seat, and off we zip. And all the adults have been drinking, you know, and she gets in a car accident, and she ends up dying a couple of days later.
Oh.
So I was in an accident when I was 14, just about to be 15, and my mom was killed.
Oh, my God, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was rough. Looking back now, you know, I'm 55 years old. You know, I've done some work on this, and then, you know, I've gotten through a lot of things. But again, I've 20 years sober will really turn things around. But it was rough, you know, and I started, going down the path of destruction, you know, if you will, and drinking and doing a lot of drugs and, you know, a little bit out of control. I think I had a little bit of a death wish in there somewhere, you know, and you know, I had good people around me. My brother and I were adopted by some real good friends of the family, and they became our legal guardians. And so, you know, here I am still getting, you know, almost 4.0 grades and you know, always coming home and doing my homework first and then, you know, sneaking out for most of the night. You know, so it went on and on like that for a while. And then, you know, jumping, I ended up getting, you know, into college. I went to UCSD, and with the help of my guardian, she was amazing. Her name was Mary Freeman, and she was just an amazing woman. And her and her husband took me and my brother in. But anyway, you know, I had some run-ins with the law along the way. Next thing you know, I had a little stint in jail, and had to drop out of school my junior year, and then jail turned into a probation, and you know, I couldn't keep my nose clean, and then that turned into actually getting sentenced to 2 years to state prison.
Okay, can I stop you there real quick?
Yeah.
What is your mindset behind bars? I mean, I've never been to jail. I've been lucky. I've never been arrested. What is your mindset when you get sent to prison?
Well, I'll tell you, it is all the things you think it is, you know, super scary. You know, I'm a big guy, you know, I'm, you know, 6'1". I've never had a lot of trouble in my life with other people, but, you know, so lucky for me, I wasn't a little bitty guy going in there, but, you know, I'm a nice guy, you know, I'm a lover, not a fighter.
Yeah.
And so, getting in there were some people that were, you know, way, way worse than me. And, you know, it's rough. I would say jail was harder than prison. Jail, you're in these cells with these different people and you're being moved around a lot. You're never really settled. Once you go to prison, and I started off at Donovan State Prison down here in San Diego.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the movies, you know, you're locked in a cell with a cellmate and, you go to the yard for a couple hours a day and you know, you're, you know, playing a lot of cards, that sort of thing. And, you know, I just was acutely aware of my surroundings. I made sure that I, you know, was careful what I said, was careful what I did. You know, I was lucky that I got in with some good guys right away.
Yeah.
And they kind of schooled me on what was going on. But, you know, I was just a little addict, alcoholic, little drug dealer, you know, is what I was. And so, you know, for me, there were guys in there. I mean, you're on the same yard with people that are doing life, you know, and it is crazy.
Were you collecting hair from the barbershop and scratching your cell wall with a penny trying to escape like Clint Eastwood?
I was not doing that, you know. And when I came in on a 2-year sentence with all the little bits of jail time I had done, I only ended up having to do like 10 or 11 months.
Yeah.
And so eventually they shipped me from Donovan up to Northern California to that kind of a dorm living type situation. And, you know, it was fine. What it was for me was a chance to have no drugs or alcohol for 10 or 11 months and purge my system of that stuff. You know,
yeah.
I was eating, you know, better. I was also, you know, lifting weights on the weight yard and that sort of thing, you know, getting healthy. And, you know, it was, once you got into the reason I think prison's a little bit easier is once you get to your spot, you know, where you're going to be, you can kind of set up shop, you know, and, get with a couple good friends and hang out and just keep your nose, you know, head down and, you know, do your time. And so, you know, it was probably the thing looking back that probably saved my life. And it was because, I went in long enough to purge that stuff, you know, all that shit, you know, and it was, you know, it was really God, I think, stepping in and helping me get on the right path.
You know, I've talked to people before who have done prison, and they've actually told me they were able to keep their hunger, if that's the right word, on drugs or alcohol. They were able to sneak it in. They were able to get it somehow. They were able to make booze through fruit or rinds or whatever. What do you guys use?
Pruno.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And they were able to do that and keep their fuel going. So did you find yourself saying, hey, I've lost that? Did you still feel an addictive feeling in yourself when you were getting towards the tail end of prison?
Yeah, you know, so no, not mostly because I was scared. So, you know, the thing that works out well for me is, you know, I do experience fear, and I can, you know, I can push through a lot of that because I'm pretty, you know, I've got that crazy gene in me, you know, but I do react well to fear. And so, you know, I was scared straight, you know, and I wanted to kick my numbers. And you get out of, you know, when you get out of the joint, you got, you know, 13 months is what it was for me back in the day.
Yeah.
To discharge your number. It was, you know, another thing is better than the 2-year probation or 3-year probation, you know, get out of prison, they want to be done with you. And so, you know, you keep your nose clean for 13 months and you're, you know, you're free willie. You're back to, you know, you're back to square one, really.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can't really say what it was like for me back then. I don't know that I can tell you Alcoholics Anonymous is what cured me of my urge to drink and to do drugs. So I probably would say I wasn't cured at that time.
Yeah.
You know, I had just not been around it. And, you know, when your life is full, as yours is and mine is today, you know, you don't find that you need to lean on a mind-altering substance, you know, every day. You know, it's just, it doesn't come up a lot, you know. And so that's probably what it was like for me, is it didn't come up a whole lot. And I was honestly, you know, I got out, I think I was 23 when I got out, maybe 24. And I, you know, I've wanted to do great things. I wanted to, you know, I was behind schedule, you know.
Yeah.
So for me, getting out was just me hitting the floor running, you know, the ground running. I wanted to, you know, to achieve all these goals I had in mind. And so, you know, that was my mindset. But, you know, funny how alcoholism is, you know, and when we say it's cunning, baffling, and powerful, man,
yeah.
I mean, you know, on steroids, you know, after 13 months, well, what do you know? I'm free willy again, you know, from the probation and, or from parole. And, you know, I can drink again. So what do? You know, I start drinking. And, you know, so I drink for a number of years after that, and I end up getting married, and, you know, I'm drinking like crazy. I get a good job, you know, and I'm climbing the corporate ladder and doing really good there. And you know, my wife actually owns the company. You know, I met her at work, and you know, we end up getting married. And so next thing you know, I'm just out of control drinking, you know, probably, you know, so drugs weren't involved at this point. Which I'm very grateful for, but what it was, you know, how we do. I'm a tornado of destruction in my life, you know, in everyone's life around me.
Did you feel it was easier? Of course, sorry to interrupt you, buddy. Did you feel it was easier, though, to just stick with alcohol and not worry about the drugs, and so you shifted in another gear, you think?
Yeah, it was for sure. But, you know, what I learned is, you know, I needed something, you know, whether it be drugs, whether it be alcohol, like, you know, I was addicted, you know, to substance, to get through my life. You know, what it was is I could not get through the trials and tribulations of daily life on life's terms without a substance, you know.
Yeah.
And the alcohol is a much easier, you know, less dark side type substance, right? You can go to the liquor store. You don't have to go to the alley, you know, and you know, so. You know, that's what it was for me, is I just, you know, it was an easier fix, really. And so what happens is my family has, my wife sets up an intervention. And it's really funny. This part of my story is sad. The other day I thought how sad it is. But so they do an intervention, and this is on like a Tuesday night.
And this is the first one you've ever had?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you know, and in my defense, part of my story is about a year before this,
yeah.
I had quit drinking. Mm-hmm. I just quit. You know, I got pancreatitis. This is why I quit.
Oh,
I got pancreatitis and didn't really know what that was. You know, but I get to the hospital and the way they treated me was substandard. And I, knowing what I know now, I realized that pancreatitis typically is an alcoholic. You know, alcoholics get it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So they I just remember being in there and in a ton of pain. And the one nurse told me, she said, just whispered in my ear one day. I was there a couple of days. She said, you know, you don't have to live this way. And, you know, you can quit drinking alcohol anytime, you know, and you don't have to live this way. So I got out and I went about a year not drinking. And what I told myself was, I'd rather, you know, I don't want to do that AA stuff. Like, I'm not doing that. You know, that's just, you know, the judges had sent me to AA and NA, you know, as a younger person during all my troubles with the law. So I had gone. I had never, ever listened to a word that they said. I couldn't have even told you how meetings were run.
Right.
You know, and I'd probably been to 50 or 100 of them. And so I get out of the hospital and I think, you know, I don't want to do all that AA stuff.
Yeah.
I'll just not drink today.
Yeah.
And so I just didn't drink today for about a year. And sure enough, you know, they talk about it in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you'll find that one day you'll have no defense against that first drink,
yeah,
except for your spiritual fitness. And I had no spiritual fitness.
Yeah.
So, you know, sure enough, you know, over the holidays, I drink. And it was an absolute debacle, probably a lot like, you know, your last run. And then I try to white knuckle it. You know, I go from like Christmas, I make it to like the Super Bowl. And then from like the Super Bowl, like 3 weeks, and then like 2 weeks. So in this year period of time, after I had gone a year without drinking, you know, it just took over my life again. And it was kind of a blessing because I got to try everything. I knew I didn't want to drink anymore. Like, I knew it was ruining my life and my health. And I could not stop. I could not stop putting alcohol in my body every day against my will.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in the book, when we read the chapter, we talk about, you know, we tried spirits, we tried wine, we tried retreats, we tried, you know, I tried, you know, switching from, you know, scotch to brandy. I spent about a year trying everything. And right before that intervention, you know, I had come to the conclusion that I was a dead man. I did not know how to stop drinking alcohol.
Yeah.
And so thoughts of suicide, you know, for me, it was, you know, suicide was all over my mind, you know, and, because I didn't know that there was another way, you know, I didn't, you know, as often as I'd been to AA and NA in the past, I did not know that I could have never done it on my own. You know, I needed a higher power to help me through it. So
now, can I ask you something real quick?
Yeah.
The medical term that you described, what was it called again?
Pancreatitis.
Oh, I know that. Now that is when they tell you, hey, dude, you can't drink anymore because if you do, it's going to fuel the fire and make it worse. You know why when I knew that I was a complete alcoholic when I was in my last McDonald's, Scripps McDonald's Center. Remember that place? 28-day rehab?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
I went there.
Yeah. Like did you? Okay. Well, my third day in, this guy comes over and he goes, hey, the doctor wants to see you. And I went in there and he goes, all right, I'm going to explain a couple things, but I'll do it in layman's terms. You see this line right here? This is where your liver is at here off to the right. If it gets past this one to the left, it's not coming back. So you can't drink again. You drink again, and you drink again like you did before, you'll die. So what did I do 3 or 4 weeks later? My mind thought about that for a second, but the power of addiction said, screw that. I'm gonna drink one more time. I'm going to relapse. What you just said about this how do I say it?
It was pancreatitis.
There you go. When you were told that, properly, you would think all of us would say, well, that's the end. That's the sign that I have to stop. But you couldn't, could you? Everything afterwards.
No. Well, and you know, it's funny, leading up to that, I had always told myself in my 20s, like, you know, if it's ever the, you know, it, for me, it was always, I'll quit when it's when I know it's hurting me physically. Like, yeah. That was my line in the sand.
Yeah.
And that's probably how I quit for that year, yeah. Which is why my story for me is so perfect, because I did. It was my health. And I heard them say that to me. And I, you know, that doctor, you know, showing you what he showed you, you know, I knew that. And so I was like, well, here it is. It's my health. And it's time to quit. So I did.
Wow.
You know, now it's just laughable to think that I thought I could do it on my own, you know?
Yeah.
And which again makes my recovery so special to me, because, you know, I've got 20 years of being in Alcoholics Anonymous and being a happy member, you know? So, you know, having that year of trying everything and having no AA and thinking, you know, I'll just not drink today rather than spend, you know, an hour going to a meeting. You know, it's just funny to me. So,
I want to get back to your spiritual thing that you had brought up, but I want to run by one thing that you had just talked about. When you had said that, you know, the spiritual fitness and the spiritual strength was not there, the AA meetings were not there, I want you to tell everybody from your own experience how the odds are on quitting outright and staying sober outright with nothing, with no spiritual fitness, no AA, no meetings, no help from others, is almost impossible. Don't you think?
I would say zero, except I know, you know, I think the statistic is, you know, maybe 3 or 4%.
Yeah.
Know? And I believe almost zero. And I have a friend that is, he's, you know, he's got 2 years, and he reads the daily, you know, our daily reflection. He doesn't have a sponsor. He doesn't go to meetings.
Yeah.
And I'm in awe of him doing that. Now, I think it's way more work for him to do that.
Yeah.
Than for us, you know,
yeah.
But here's the thing, Bromo. I was taught by some of the hardcores, you know, I was so grateful. I started off at Betty Ford, and after Betty Ford, they sent me straight to the McDonald's Center.
Right.
And I you know, and we'll get to that in a second, but I was in there with a couple guys, Doug Hopkins. This guy was Yoda for me, and he had 5 or 6 more years, you know, 5 or 6 years when I met him, and I was brand new. And he was hardcore, and he was, you know, when someone would go out and drink, he would go, that's better odds for us.
Like, yeah.
What do you mean? He goes, the odds just got better for us.
Yeah.
And he was one of those ones that would say to me, you missed your meeting this week. And and you didn't go, so you haven't had a meeting in 2 weeks. And I go, what do you mean? It's been a week. He goes, dude, look at the calendar. He's like, it's been 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he really was brutal, and I liked it. It really helped me. But one of the things, what were we just talking about?
I interrupted you when you were getting to the spiritual fitness stage, but if you can think about what you was on your mind before, and this is one of the things I do really bad. I interrupt people a lot. Sorry.
No, you're fine. I get rambling too, buddy.
No, you don't. No, you don't. You're fine.
But when it comes to, what Doug taught me is that we're all going to relapse, man. You know, and maybe he said it to scare me, but it worked.
Yeah.
And my friend who Andy, who's got 2 years and he doesn't really have the program, you know, I believe, Bromo, there's a relapse in your future. And in my future, I got 20 years. You got it coming up on 16. You know, I believe that there's a relapse right in front of me. And it is only by the things that I do that I've learned from Alcoholics Anonymous on a daily basis that keep that relapse at bay.
Wow.
So, you know, if you and I can relapse, you know, within a foot and a half reach of a cocktail, right?
Yeah.
You know, that person that has, you know, that has no program, you know, I just think the odds of that person relapsing is just, you know, is just off the charts. And, you know, and let's be clear too, we're not talking about a year. We're talking about long-term sobriety.
Right.
I don't want a year or two.
Right.
We're talking about sobriety that sticks and
we
die sober, you know, and I don't know that, without the tools of the program that really you can ever achieve sobriety, without it, you know? And if I've offended anyone out there, or there's anyone that's rocking it with, you know, with no program, you know, good for you. I do believe it's possible. It just is a lot of work.
It's haunting. And I'm glad you just said that. And listen, you don't need to apologize to anybody, because there are people that come up to me and say, you know what, they don't say I've never gone to a meeting. They say, quote, I stopped one day and I've been sober ever since. I just didn't want it anymore. And, you know, I don't sit there and question them and put them under the microscope. But I do ask maybe a couple things like, well, did you go to meetings? How did you eventually just stop? And the guy goes, I just didn't want it anymore. And so I haven't had a drink in like 17 years. And I'm thinking, wow, same thing. I'm shocked as well. Wow. Wow.
And you know, not to take anything from them.
Right.
You know, heck, we play cards with one of the guys at our table that we play with.
Right.
You know very well. He doesn't drink, and he just quit. And I wonder, and again, not to take anything away from them, but maybe they weren't alcoholics. You know, the book talks about, you know, four different types of drinkers. You know, there's a heavy drinker. There's the real alcoholic. But maybe they weren't, I don't know, if they were an alcoholic like me and a drug addict like me, I don't know how you would do it without program. You know, I didn't have any tools. And my connection with my higher power and God was absent, you know, so I would have never gotten, I don't know how I would have gotten there without AA. Maybe through religion, you know, there's a couple people that I know that they've, they started off in AA and they flipped over to just church, and that works for them. But, you know, I just, like I said, that fear thing, I'm afraid to change anything in my recipe.
Maybe you can relate to this. When I first tried to stay sober, and I did once for 2 or 3 weeks, I missed it so much. I went out and I bought non-alcoholic beer, which is a dangerous thing for someone like me. And I sat there and I said, you know what? This is good. This is really good. You know, it's not like I like the taste of beer. I wanted that effect that real beer alcohol has, but I was like masking that. I was drinking, but that was just toying with me, man. And then I remember thinking, I can have one beer a night. Hey, that's a good goal. One beer as a reward a night. And, you know, you laugh because literally when you tell yourself that, you're just fooling yourself. Because, you know, people will tell me, my old counselors, dude, that's a ruse. You try one beer a night, before you know it, 2 days later, it'll be two beers a night. And then three, and then four, and then boom, you're back to the path you were at.
Yeah, sneaking, hiding, drinking every day, drinking on the job, you know?
Yeah.
It goes fast. I mean, you know, I'm so grateful that I can just, you know, even after 20 years, I can remember what it was like, you know, waking up the next morning, and, it's vivid.
And don't you think that's armor for us to have, to be armed with those memories?
Yeah. 1,000%. But for me, it was only because when I was in the asylum and they were teaching me about these things, they taught me to play the tape. So if no one had ever told me, you know, run it through in your mind, go ahead and think, play that drink out, right? And then run it through that evening, and then the next day, and the next day. I don't need to go past the next day. I'll just tell you, I don't need to go, you know, 2 and 3 days later, a week later, a month later. I will be drinking and hiding alcohol all around my house the very next day.
Oh, my God,
hiding it from my wife, lying to my wife.
Yes.
And, you know, it's an instant thing for me.
It's a time bomb.
You know, and I'm really grateful that it is, that I'm such a real alcoholic, because I see people in the rooms that really struggle with, am I not?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was kind of mild. Maybe it was a little light and fluffy. You know, I was just hardcore. And so I don't spend 1 second wondering if I'm an alcoholic or not. Not 1 second.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And then that gives me time, you know, that frees up my brain to go ahead and get to work. You know, I'd rather spend my energy on the work to stay sober than, you know, wondering if I was. And, you know, in that little crack of daylight, boy, alcoholism would just get right in there. And I'd be thinking like you, like, maybe I can have one beer.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You know what? So now I'm fascinated by spiritual fitness, because when I was at Freedom Ranch and I was isolated, we're out in Campo and a bunch of guys and everything, and we're living there. And our teacher had said, look, you need a higher power, whether it's a doorknob, whether it's God, whether it's this or that. And for me, of course, I've always believed in God, so that was not a problem for me. But I remember when I was in the deepest darkness of my drinking, you know, I didn't turn to God. I didn't think about him. I didn't ask for any kind of help. That was part of my shame, I think. You brought up spiritual fitness, and I think that's so important.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny you say that. I was just like you. I believed in God, and it wasn't until I was doing my steps with my first sponsor that, you know, when I made the list of people I had harmed, I did not have, it was just so eye-opening. I didn't have myself on the list, and I didn't have God on the list.
Yeah.
And, you know, those were the top two for me.
Yeah.
You know, especially God. I was so mad at God, you know. So I had always believed in God, but I was spiritually bankrupt when I came in.
You were mad at God because you felt like he should have taken that addiction crave away from you?
Yeah, you know, it started with my mom. Like, fuck you, God.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I, you know,
I can't even relate. You know, I can't relate.
He killed my mom. You know, on one level, I thought, you know, he killed my mom. And of course, I've had time to work on that. You know, it's funny. I was in Betty Ford, you know, the very first week in my counseling group, you know, actually my one-on-one group with my counselor.
Yeah.
And they realized I had done, and I'm 23. My mom died when I was, let's see, what was it? No, I would have been 35. I was 35. And my mom passed away when I was turning 15.
Yeah.
And they realized I had done no grief counseling or
right.
anything. So as a young person, you know, my guardians did a lot of things for me. They did a ton of things. But I guess it just didn't come up that I should probably work on some of that grief from my mom's accident. So they gave me some things to do and some books to read. And, you know, but I held that anger, you know, and resentment towards everyone, everything, you know. About my mom dying for a while. And it wasn't until I was in, you know, there and getting sober, my path to recovery, that I really did some work on that. And, you know, I'm not mad at God anymore whatsoever about that or anything else, you
yeah.
know, but it reconnected me with God, you know, and, I'll tell you you know, along my path, I've had a couple of different sponsors, but you know, Rick, and he's amazing.
Yeah,
and,
he is.
I remember sharing with Rick one day, I said, you know, and this was just a few years ago, and I said, hey, I'm really struggling. You know, God's putting all these hurdles in my life, and I'm struggling. And he said, whoa, whoa, whoa. He said, God doesn't put hurdles in our life. He helps us get over them. And
yeah.
I go, what? And he goes, God doesn't put you know, hurdles for us to, you know, God helps us jump them. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks, and I'm still to this day a little confused by it. I guess my interpretation is that life happens, you know, I'm related to God. Life goes on, you know,
yeah.
You have a kid, you don't have a kid, you move up where you're at, you know, you come up, whatever it is, life happens. And, you know, the business that I'm in right now is suffering a lot from these last couple of years, you know, of the economy and stuff. And, you know, life happens. I don't blame God for any of those things. But, boy, leaning on God to help me get through that stuff, it was like a shift in my paradigm. You know, it changed everything for me.
Yeah.
So, you know, me and God are buddies. You know, God helps me, you know, as often as I call on him. And so for me.
Well, he doesn't help out your golf game, it sounds.
No, he sure doesn't. I was just praying to him on Thursday. Yeah.
Sorry, pal. Yeah, I couldn't resist. I couldn't resist. Sorry,
you know,
buddy.
It's it's, you know, and I struggle with how to pray. You know, my prayers these days are just asking God to help me be okay with how things go.
Yeah.
Because things are going to go the way they go. You said, so I think before we started this call, you know, when we were talking off the record, you know, that there's a lot of things that we can't control, you know, and so knowing I can't control these things, they're just going to go how they go.
Yeah.
And I just ask God to help me be all right with it, you know. And boy, is that's where you get your serenity, and that's where you get your peace.
You know, I thought of something just a couple seconds ago when you were talking about Rick and talking about this and that. I think when you're getting sober and when you're staying sober, the warning signs are simple for me. I remember when I tried to stay sober and I started avoiding people. Like, I would think if you've been sober like 5 or 6 years, and you've seen it from people in the group at meetings and such, if you see people disappear, if you see people avoid the phone call to you, or you're trying to stay, when disappearing starts happening, that's a dark, dark flag right there, don't you think?
Yeah, that's the beginning. Well, I mean, I think that's when they go out.
Yeah,
you know?
Me too.
I don't, you know, my recipe, for sobriety is just what it's been from the beginning. You know, they told me to get a sponsor, to go to meetings, to do the steps, you know, to fellowship, you know, all the things that you and I both do. And I have been afraid. Again, there's that fear. You know, I've been afraid to change anything. Now, I might have gone from you know, 4 or 5 meetings a week, 3 or 4 meetings a week, down to 1. Right now I do 1 a week. It's mm-hmm. my noon meeting on Wednesday. And, you know, we talked about this with your dream and with, you know, maybe being dry. You know, sobriety has given me a family, and I've got, you know, older kids, and I've got a 6-year-old son, and my life is so full that, that I don't make it to a meeting as often as I used to, but I do other things, you know, where I took away a little bit of salt or sugar in my recipe. I add a little extra flour, you know, and I play golf with a sober buddy. I play cards with some sober guys, you know, talking with you on the phone. So, you know, I don't know what part of the recipe is the one that works, but I just know that the people that don't go to meetings, I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you stay sober. And I've got story after story after story of people coming in after having 5 years, 7 years,
yeah,
10 years, 2 years.
Yeah,
and they say, you know, I stopped going to meetings.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
then I drink.
Once you stay, I've had people tell me that before. Our old cook from Pathfinders, which was one of the guys that would sit in our meetings once a week with our house, he would say, once you detach yourself from AA, from people that are in our elite group, that you would say, you might want to question yourself. You know, you had talked about playing poker, playing cards, playing golf with a sober, great friend of ours. This guy is super smart, and he's super in tune with feelings about others. And, you know, you had said to me on the phone, you had relayed to our buddy that, like, this podcast for me is like a meeting. The way I look at it, yes, I'm not sitting in a chair. Yes, I'm not drinking a cup of coffee, and I'm not listening to others. I am listening to a really cool guy right now who's I consider one of my deepest friends. And this, to me, is a meeting, without a doubt. And this is what I'm trying to relay to others. I wanted to bring something by you real quick as far as triggers. You remember Scripps McDonald Center, right?
Yep.
This was a very spacious, beautiful. It was like a hotel, but it was like a hospital, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And they had, like, music therapy and things like that. And now, I'm not bashing anything. Like you and I have both said, whatever works, works. But I remember I was there during New Year's Eve, okay? And they had all told us, all 15 of us, we're going to get together right around 11:50 tonight and ring in the new year. And I remember looking over, and the counselors were setting up plastic champagne glasses as they brought in apple cider champagne bottles. And I'm like, damn, is this isn't a trigger? I don't know what is.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I tell you, my buddy Doug, he was like, no fruity drinks,
yeah.
No near beer, no none of that. You know, he's like, why would you be in the barber shop, you know, if you don't want to get your hair cut?
Yeah.
Like, none of that. And I heeded his advice on all those accounts. And so it freaks me out when people do the near beer thing and, you know, the bubbly. I don't want anything to remind me of a cocktail at all, you know, whatsoever.
Nothing. And let me ask you this. Will you run by us real quick the feeling of what it's like driving to your meeting, parking your car, and walking into such a place that are all over the country? This is your home when you walk in and you see people. You may see a newcomer. You may see someone that's been there forever, like one of your old grizzly veterans. You see people that you can bond with. Tell me what that's like and what your thoughts are and what you listen for if you hear someone talk and you know they're in pain.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there. Let me first just say this, that, you know, after I got plugged into Alcoholics Anonymous and I started going to our meetings and meeting my guys, you and our friends, you know, the ones you're referring to, those are my guys. You know, I've got other friends and I've got family, but the people that I truly enjoy, like, I love my meetings and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. My favorite people, you know, the people that I can tell anything to, like you know, you're one of my dearest friends, you know, our other buddy, you know, I can call on you guys at any time. It's amazing. The quality of friends I have gotten from being sober and being in Alcoholics Anonymous is just, there's nothing like it on the planet.
No.
So, you know, number one, I get to go see those guys when I go to my meeting.
Yeah.
Number one. So, you know, going there and pulling up, it's just, you know, it's like going to a party. I mean, and sometimes, you know, we have so much fun and crack so many jokes, we almost have to dial it back a little bit. There's been times where, you know, some of my core guys, we used to take a meeting into Mesa Vista Hospital. So we would come in from the outside and the patients would come in from the inside. And, you know, it was 7 or 8, 10 of us. We all go to dinner. I went to, you know, at about 2 years, I started going to dinner with this group of guys. They kind of forced me to go with them. I didn't really want to because I kind of was on the outside, you know, the outskirts of the herd.
Right.
And I knew as soon as I said yes to this dinner on Wednesday night, I was going to be locked into the herd. And so, you know, I did. And we went until COVID. I went for probably 13, 14 years to this. We go to this one diner before Wednesday night meeting, and then we go to this meeting. And you know, there'd be so many of us cracking jokes and having fun that we almost had to dial back some. It was so much fun.
Yeah.
You know, and I think some of the patients that were in there, it appealed to them because we were not a glum lot. You know, we were having fun, and it was obvious, you know, that sobriety could be fun. So, you know, what it's like for me is it's the safest space on the planet. And I know, you know, safe space has kind of become a joke these days, you know, with people needing their space, you know, their safe spaces on campus and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you that for people like us, going into any room, you know, even an outside meeting at the park, any space where there's an AA meeting, for me, it's like my people. It's like it's just coming to a spot where people get me automatically. I can say anything that I want.
Yeah.
And mostly I get to listen to people share, you know, either how I'm feeling or having dealt with something I'm dealing with, or, you know, later on they've said something that I can recall that helped them through a situation that now I find myself in. It's just amazing. And really, you know, I was taught by Doug long ago that when I go to those meetings, I'm not really there for me. I mean, I definitely get what I need to stay sober.
Right.
But I'm there to try and affect the sobriety of someone that's in there,
yeah,
whether they've got 20 years, whether they're brand new. And I'd like green meetings, you know, with a lot of newcomers, because I feel like, you know, I get an opportunity to show them what it's like, show them how it can be, you know, maybe say something that will affect them.
Yeah.
And that's always my goal at a meeting. I mean, I go to these meetings where people drone on and on about, you know, themselves and you know, their poor me, their lives, whatever. And I used to be like that, and I got reminded by my friends, you know, that's not what this is for. You know, Doug would tell me, look, call me after the meeting. If you want to talk about that, you call me. But when you're in a meeting, you know, I want to see you share something and try and try and bring sobriety to the meeting and have someone get something from your share.
Yeah.
So, you know.
You know what? This is what I want to say real quick. This is what I want to tell you. When I remember going to Pathfinders in my first, you know, within my first year, and some of the people telling me, you know what? And I hear the Grizzly guys get up in front of the podium. They would say the newcomers. I learned something from them. And I remember thinking in my head, BS, you've been sober 17 years. How are you going to learn something from me? From Bromo, yeah, from who's brand new 8 months. But it's so true. The newcomers are so important. And for anybody out there who's listening to this that just started going to meetings, don't ever feel ashamed to share, or how long you want to share, or not even share. Just say, hey, I'm here to listen. You know, I've had bullies before, Patrick, in the background of our meetings, who would say, hey, it's been 3 minutes. Wait till you get to 5 years before you can share longer. You know, stupid stuff like that, you know what, that dangerously chases people away and never goes back to those meetings because of that. And shame on those people. Shame on you. Sorry,
for
buddy.
Sure.
Sorry, buddy.
No doubt.
Say that.
Yeah, no doubt whatsoever. And, you know, and the other thing I'll just say right off the bat there is, you know, there's so many meetings, at least down here and in a lot of areas where people are, you know, especially like San Diego and the big cities.
Yeah.
That if there's a meeting you don't like, go to a different one. You know, there's tons.
Yeah.
You know, and you can always find you're going to find a meeting that's got your people for sure. But it's, you know, like you said, don't be afraid to share. Don't be afraid to say what's on your mind. You know, if you really need to get something off your chest, that's the place to do it. You know?
Yeah, and you know, nowadays there's so many things you could do. You can download an app called Sober Sidekick, and you can go on there, and there's meetings around the clock. You can just observe. You can listen, you know?
Yeah. You can be a fly on the wall.
You can. And, you know,
and I was just going to say, I'll tell you, you know, for anyone out there listening, it is the easier, softer way. I mean, it is 1,000% the easier, softer way. Takes a little bit of work in the beginning,
but
before you know it, you're just cruising, and your life is beyond your wildest imagination. I mean, you know, I hear that from every single sober person. I mean, you know, it's just, you couldn't have scripted your life this way once you get sober.
Let me ask you this real quick for those of you who are new. And listen, I'm not labeling anybody, but I just, if you're curious of these questions, Patrick, why do I need to do the steps? Why do I need a sober? Why do I need a sponsor? Duh.
Yeah, so I would say that's one of the most important things. So, you know, here's, like for me, for example, you know, I came in, you know, again, I remember I was on that list. I was on my list, you know, of people I had resentments towards, you know, God, myself. And I came in thinking I was just, you know, a POS. You know, I was just an awful human being, a terrible person. I was no good, you know, and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, they're designed so perfectly. You know, you start going through your steps with a sponsor, and the reason you need a sponsor is you can't do this by yourself. Not only do you need a sponsor to help you get through the steps, but a sponsor becomes, you know, kind of like your confidant, someone that it's your conciliary, you know, someone that you can share things with, and they can help guide you through the turbulence of, you know, being new in sobriety for sure. But even having years of sobriety, things come up, and your sponsor is someone you can lean on that can give you advice. But when you do these steps, you systematically go through your life and you purge. You clean house, right? You get your side of the street clean. You make a list of things you've done. You go out to people that you've caused harm, and you make things right to the best of your ability. Yeah. And by the time you finish the steps, you love yourself again. You know, yeah. I'm not a piece of shit. You know, I'm a good guy with something to offer. And I don't know how people can stay sober carrying all of the shame and all of the all that goes with that when you're drinking like we drank, you know, and causing all the destruction in our lives like we did. Yep. I don't know how you can, you know, I would say it's a dry drunk. You know, you've quit drinking, but you haven't done any of the work that has you shed all of that trash and put all those rocks down and just, you know, live your life. And the steps are just paramount.
Yeah, the steps and a sponsor are part of your armor. And you need that. And, you know, the number one step, obviously, is the number one thing that once you realize you can conquer that, well, we can never really conquer it. You can conquer it. Those who think, no way could I ever go 1 or 2 or 3 days without drinking. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and our lives had become unmanageable. And how true is that? We know when our lives are spinning out of control. And we know when we're staying sober how little things are coming back to you, like taking care of bills and, you know, being with people and going out and not lying and cheating, not expecting a phone call from a bill collector, not thinking that your car is going to get repoed, like all the things that I went through. Having yourself look at yourself in the mirror when you wake up and say, man, I've been sober and I feel good about it. I don't feel controlled by the bottle or the drink, you know?
Yeah, it's amazing. You're nailing it. You know, it's all those things. It's really getting back to life.
Yeah, it's so. And look, I've almost had you on an hour, and this has been one of my coolest podcasts because I know you and I miss you so much. And I remember once I was doing an event at the stadium, and you were part of a live show that I was I had come back from Bismarck to be a participant in, and I was wearing some contrapment.
Yeah. Boy, I can't rocket. Speak. I can't. Did you have rocket strapped to your back?
I can't speak today. I was wearing some sort of outfit with something hardly on down below and a rocket on my back, and I was in a thong. That was it. And I had stuff oozing out of me, and you had come over to me and gave me a big bear hug. And I remember seeing you, like I said, once or twice a year when I come out. I didn't get a chance to see you last time. It's part of what is so rewarding is when you do turn your life around, you do admit to yourself you're powerless, and you stay sober, and you meet such great people with such strength like you and my friend and others that we play cards with and golf with. It is a real it's a real honor to be a part of that. Like you said, you know, isn't it something? It really is. Like you said, it's an elite, strong, great feeling. My friend chewed me out the other day because I didn't call him right away. He goes, dude, what do you think I'm here for? You can call me anytime.
Yeah.
And he's right.
Yeah, so, that's probably one of our biggest shortcomings is we're afraid to reach out and, you know, bug someone in the program when we've got a little thing to go over, you know. And it helps them as much as it helps you.
Can you wrap all this up? And I know I'm a terrible host sometimes where I interrupt and stuff. And you know, you and I have seen many times in meetings where people chronologically go through their story. And I hope you were able to tell your story. I'm sure you left a lot out because I interrupt so much, but the main point of what you talked about was how you faced what you were going through, and I didn't know about your mom, and I feel terrible about it, and I can't even imagine that, and what you told us about being spiritually fit and being armed with tools that gets you by this. Will you kind of tell everybody and sum this all up, first of all, how you can do it, how there is a way out? I mean, people might say, you know what, I'm afraid. You had said way earlier this podcast that you didn't know how. I wrote it down. You said you didn't know how to stop drinking. Well, that's a typical question for those who are chained to it and handcuffed to the drink and the bottle and the drug. There's a point where you want to change, but you're so afraid. You're afraid of what people are going to think about you if you reveal that you have a problem. But tell everybody how glorious it is and how there is a way out, will you?
Yeah, well, for sure. And boy, you're summing it up pretty well for me right there. But, you know, I would just say this, you know, as you were just going through all that, I was thinking, you know, here's what I was. I was an alcoholic, drug addict, convict, college dropout is what I was, that could not stop drinking and doing drugs against my will every single day. And, you know, and now I am a person that I own my own business. I'm pretty successful in business. I've got a family. I've got kids in college. I've got a 6-year-old. I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. And how did all that happen, you know, for me? It's as simple as walking in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Wow.
You know, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did what I was told. You know, people say, you know, that it's a program of suggestions or a suggested program. You know, I take those suggestions as instructions. You know, it's a blueprint for how to stop drinking alcohol and live your life. And it is spectacularly simple. But like anything in life that is worth, you know, anything, it takes work, And, you know, the work for me today is like this, hanging out in my garage on my phone, talking to my buddy Bromo. You know, this is what the work is like for me today. It's fun. You know, I get to go play golf and play cards and go to a meeting and see my friends.
Yeah.
You know, it's not work at all. As a matter of fact, it's my favorite part of my week.
That's awesome.
In the beginning it was work. And you get a sponsor, someone that you like, you know, that you can relate to, that has what you want. You know, you want some long-term sobriety, find a sponsor with some sobriety. And you just do a few simple things, just a little bit at a time.
Yeah.
And your life, number one, you'll be physically sober. You'll stop putting substances into your body, period.
Yeah.
And then from there, the sky's the limit. It's just unbelievable.
Well, I'm going
to end. It's the greatest part of my life.
That's so cool. And you're such a great guy, and I want to end with this real quick and see what your thoughts are. And you don't have, if you are in agreement with what I'm going to tell you, what these people say, what a few people have told me, that's cool, because you know me, you're able to speak your mind, whether I, it's not going to offend me at all. I've had just a few people, not a lot. The reason why I stopped for a while is I had a few people tell me, Bromo, you can't mention AA, you can't do this, you can't mention certain things, because we know the deal, right, Patrick, media and film, this and this, this. You can't mention AA, you can't mention meetings, or you can't mention this and that, this or that. Okay, the reason why I do this podcast is because people can reach out on their own. This isn't being aired on the radio. This is going to be aired on demand, and I think 6 or 7 other podcast platforms where you can choose to go on there, and which I hope, this is why I do this, which you can choose to go on there and listen to the whole thing. Now, if you come across anybody who likes to sit there and preach behind the podium and tell people that they're full of beep and that they're a-holes and we're all cheats and liars and thieves. Yeah, we've all cheated and lied and thieved, but I do this. Maybe I have broken some codes and stuff, but you know what? It's not going to air on the radio. It won't be on CBS or NBC. I want people to go, what is this all podcast all about? Someone told me about it, and they can go in and listen to it for themselves. What is your feeling on that? Have I done anything out of, you know, that I shouldn't be doing?
No, not at all. And I say another thing they say about AA is, you know, you take what you want and leave the rest. You know, if you take what you want from this podcast, if it helps you, great. If it doesn't, leave it, you know. And I commend you, Bromo, for doing what you're doing, for doing this 12-step and reaching out to people and putting yourself out there, you know, and doing the work to help another person. You know, imagine if one person hears this and gets sober, you know, because of something one of us said. You know, it's all worth it. And I I think it's amazing. I think it's a great platform, and I don't care what anyone thinks.
You're awesome.
I'm just proud to be, you know, your friend, and I'm proud to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it is the greatest part of my life.
And you know what? I promise you, I'll end with this. I remember back in the old days, if somebody would come up to me and say, man, you were funny when you were on DSC. I laughed. I went out and saw you pay off bets, and you made me laugh with bits that you had on the show with Dave, and you guys were genius. Great. I'll never forget those. However, and this has happened to you, I guarantee you, when I have somebody say to me and reach out on an email, Bromo, I heard you speak at the Freedom Ranch. I am now 6 years sober. I was sitting in the front row so scared and questioning, why am I here? I want to go out and drink. And I heard you speak. Something struck a chord. I'm now 6 years sober. That's happened to you, I know. And I got to tell you, isn't that the greatest feeling in the world?
It's the greatest ever. It's like giving life to someone. It's, you know, and being in the club, you know, we know what that means for them. We know where their life is headed, you know, and we better, and even more powerful, we know where their life was going, you know, before.
Yeah.
It's death, institutions, jail.
Yeah. You know what Freedom Ranch is all about. There's 40 men and they're all sitting in the classroom, and in the back row, there's several of those men that have been there quite a while, like about, you know, 4 or 5 months. The front row is all reserved for people brand new, and the teacher would come out, and I love the story, and he would say, take a look to your left, to your right. Take a look behind you. The odds are on this. After a year, if two of you are sober, that's about the odds, because most of you will be unheard of for again. Most of you will be jailed, and some of you will be dead. And I remember thinking, yeah, this is really, oh, wow, you sold me, but it's so true.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, Bromo, I love you, buddy.
Yeah, hang on. I'm going to put a close to this, Patrick. I've taken way too much of your time. Hang on real quick. I'll tell you over and over and over again. I'm extremely proud of anyone that comes on here and shares. That's a lot to do. And Patrick is such a great guy. And everything he said is so true. For any of you out there who have a family member, friends, you can see it in their eyes. You know what? Have them listen to this. My name is Bromo, and there is a way out.